So we are looking at this frankly massive stack of FINRA rule books and SEC regulatory filings today.
It's intimidating.
Oh, it's a lot. And I have to admit, usually when we talk about a diagnostic process, there's this expectation of precision. You know, like if you break your arm, the X-ray shows that jagged white line.
Right,
And the
right.
doctor just points out and says, "There it is, broken or not broken, it's clean."
Yeah, it's binary, which is comforting. I mean, we like things to be visible and neatly categorized.
Exactly. But then you step into this world of financial regulations and securities law, which is exactly what this huge stack of paper is about. And suddenly that X-ray machine is just totally broken. We are looking at a regulatory landscape that is incredibly murky.
Oh, absolutely.
So today we are conquering the primary market. Your mission as a listener prepping for the Series 6 is to really master the rules of soliciting business and new issues.
And not just to memorize the flashcards, right?
Right, exactly. You need to see the matrix of how these rules actually work and like why they were written in the first place.
Yeah, that is honestly the only way to survive this exam, because if you don't understand the underlying logic, like the actual why behind the SEC's demands, the exam writers will absolutely trap you in those muddy
They
waters.
will sink you. But before we clear up that mud, just a really quick word. This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel. They've got a full Series 6 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CertFuel.com.
It's a lifesaver.
It really is. Okay, let's unpack this. To make this stick, especially if you're like me and your brain just sort of checks out during dry textbook readings, we are going to visualize these regulations using a recurring cast of characters.
I love this approach.
Yeah, it helps so much. So first up, we have Frank the founder.
Ah, yes, a critical player in our regulatory ecosystem.
He's great. Frank is this like chaotic, visionary entrepreneur. He is trying to take his company public. Now, Frank's company makes prescription sunglasses for dogs.
They're dogs, right?
We're going to start out treating this like a silly startup, but as Frank grows, we'll see this evolve into a highly complex canine ocular health technology firm.
Of course.
So, to sell his stock, Frank hires our second character, Devious Dave the Dealer.
Devious Dave.
Yeah, Dave is a broker-dealer who basically loves cutting corners whenever he thinks the SEC isn't looking.
Oh, we all know a Dave. And our third character.
Finally, we have cautious Carla the customer. She is our target retail investor. Carla works hard for her money, and she is just trying not to lose her shirt in the market, you know?
Yeah, and that dynamic right there, the visionary, the salesman, and the retail investor, that is the exact tension the Securities Act of 1933 was designed to manage.
Right.
Because before Frank the founder can legally sell a single share of his dog sunglasses empire to cautious Carla, he has to navigate the SEC's incredibly strict timeline for new issues.
Okay, yes, the timeline. So, looking through your notes here, we are dealing with the three phases of registration: pre-registration, the cooling off period, and the post-effective period.
Right. Three distinct phases.
Let me try an analogy here, because I'm reading the rules on what Dave can and can't do, and this whole process basically sounds like throwing an exclusive VIP party.
Okay, let's see how that holds up against the federal statutes.
Okay, so phase one, pre-registration. This is when you were just planning the party. Frank and Dave are booking the DJ, buying the snacks, writing the guest list. But crucially, no invitations are allowed.
None.
You cannot even whisper that this party is happening. No offers, no sales, no solicitation.
Yeah, and the historical context here is key. Like back in the 1920s, before these rules existed, promoters would hype up a stock before a company even had a business plan.
Just totally selling vapor.
Exactly. They'd create a frenzy and take people's money overnight. So the SEC created the pre-registration phase to kill that hype cycle. The regulators don't even have Frank's paperwork yet. So if Devious Dave starts telling Carla about the party right now, he is committing a violation called gun jumping.
Gun jumping. I love that visual. Okay, then Frank finally gets his act together and files the actual registration statement with the SEC. Boom, we enter phase two, the cooling off period.
Right.
The notes say this is a minimum of 20 days. So, in my party analogy, this is like sending out the save the dates. You can talk about the party, people know it exists, but you still cannot buy a ticket. No money changes hands.
That's right.
And finally, phase three, post-effective. The SEC says go. Doors open, the bouncer steps aside, take the money, party time.
That framework works perfectly, but we really need to zoom in heavily on that middle
The
phase.
cooling off period.
Yes, the 20-day cooling off period, because That is where the Series 6 exam is going to set its traps.
Okay.
During this time, Devious Dave is legally allowed to give Cautious Carla a document called a preliminary prospectus. It's often referred to as a red herring.
All right. So if you are listening to this right now, maybe you're walking the dog, maybe you're driving. You think about this scenario. I'm asking you directly.
Yeah, pay attention to this one.
We're in that 20-day cooling off period. Dave, the dealer, gives Cautious Carla this red herring. Carla reads it. She loves the dog sunglasses idea. She thinks it's a billion-dollar market. She is literally begging Dave to take her money. Can Dave just take her check and, like, hold it for her?
I know common sense might suggest he could at least hold the check in escrow or put it in a drawer.
Just sit on it.
Right. But the regulatory answer is absolutely not. He cannot accept a single cent. He can only take what's called an indication of interest.
Okay.
And here is the first major exam trap. Indications of interest are completely non-minding both ways.
Let me reason through that.
Sure.
Both ways. Meaning, even if Carla screams, I am 100% in, she isn't legally on the hook.
Correct. The SEC considers an indication of interest to be nothing more than a conversation. Carla is not legally forced to buy, and Dave is not legally allowed to sell.
What?
Once that registration finally goes post-effective and the doors open, Dave still has to call Carla back and explicitly reconfirm her order. He cannot just auto-draft her account because she sounded enthusiastic 2 weeks ago.
Which protects Carla from getting swept up in the hype and regretting it later, right?
Exactly.
But what about the document itself, the red herring? Why the colorful name?
It actually comes from the red letter disclaimer printed directly on the cover.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it literally says in red ink, like, this registration is not yet effective. We cannot accept offers to buy. It serves as this giant, unavoidable warning label that this is essentially just a rough draft.
Okay, so if it's a rough draft, what is it missing? Because the exam definitely wants us to know the difference between the preliminary and the final prospectus, right?
Absolutely. There are three specific pieces of information missing from a red herring. Number one is the final offering price.
Right.
It might have a suggested range, like $10 to $12 a share, but the final price hasn't been set by the market yet. Number two is the effective date.
Right, because we don't know exactly when the SEC is going to give the green light.
Precisely. And number three is the net proceeds to the issuer.
Well, that's just basic math, right?
Yeah.
If you don't know the final offering price, you can't possibly calculate how much cash Frank, the founder, is actually going to walk away with after Dave takes his fees.
That's the exact logic. If you understand the why, you don't even have to memorize that list. It just makes sense.
Yeah, that's super helpful. Now, speaking of the SEC giving the green light, you mentioned earlier that the cooling off period is a minimum of 20 days.
Right, minimum.
Yeah, that's what the notes say. Minimum 20 days. So does that mean on day 21, Devious Dave can just automatically start taking Carla's money?
This is trap number two. The word minimum is doing a lot of heavy lifting there. The SEC controls that timeline, not Frank, and definitely not Dave.
Oh, okay.
If the SEC regulators are reading Frank's registration statement and they realize he completely failed to explain, I don't know, how he's manufacturing these tiny dog sunglasses, maybe he left out a huge supply chain risk.
Like, where's the glass coming from?
Exactly. They will issue a deficiency letter.
And a deficiency letter pauses the clock.
It halts the 20-day clock entirely until Frank submits the corrected paperwork.
Yay.
And if the SEC finds something actually malicious or fraudulent, they escalate from a deficiency letter to a stop order, which halts the offering altogether.
Man, so the SEC really has their foot hovering over the brake pedal the entire time.
All the time.
All right, let's look at the actual mechanics of selling this stuff. Frank needs this stock sold, which is why he brought in Devious Dave, the dealer, in the first place. But who actually holds the risk here? If this dog sunglasses stock is a complete flop, who is left holding the bag?
That entirely depends on the specific underwriting agreement Dave signs with Frank. The Series 6 exam will constantly ask you to contrast two main types of underwriting contracts, firm commitment and best efforts.
Okay, let me try to puzzle this out. Firm commitment.
Right.
If I'm Dave and I'm making a firm commitment, that sounds like I'm guaranteeing Frank the money. Mm-hmm. So Dave acts as a principal, right? He buys the entire lot of shares from Frank up front.
You've got it. Dave essentially writes Frank a massive check. Frank gets his capital, he high-fives his team, and goes back to the dog park to build his company. Frank is completely de-risked at that point.
Wow. Okay. But Dave now owns millions of shares of dog sunglasses stock.
Exactly. And Dave has to resell that stock to the public, to people like Carla, to make his profit. If the market rejects the idea and nobody wants the stock, Dave eats the entire loss. The financial risk sits entirely with the underwriter.
Why would Dave ever agree to that, though? Like, why take on all that risk for Frank's crazy startup?
Because in a firm commitment, Dave gets to buy those shares at a significant discount. It's called the underwriting spread.
Ah.
If Dave has already quietly polled his institutional clients, and he knows there is a massive demand for this canine health tech, it's essentially easy money. He buys it from Frank for $10 and sells it to the public for $12.
So he just pockets the $2 a share.
Exactly. But what if Dave isn't so sure? What's the alternative contract?
That would be the best efforts underwriting. In this scenario, the notes say Dave acts as an agent. So he doesn't buy the shares. He just acts as a middleman, like a hype man.
Right.
He promises to try his absolute best to sell them to cautious Carla. And if he can't sell them,
the unsold shares go right back to Frank the founder. In a best efforts deal, the risk stays firmly with the issuer. Frank might only raise half the money he actually needed.
Frank would definitely hate that. He wants the firm commitment, for sure. Now, whether Dave buys them all or just tries to sell them, he usually doesn't do this alone, right?
Yeah.
The source material talks about underwriting syndicates and selling groups. Are those just two words for the same thing?
That is a massive misconception, and the exam totally preys on it. They are fundamentally different in terms of liability.
Oh, really?
Yeah. If it's a huge offering, Dave might form an underwriting syndicate. This is a group of other broker-dealers who sign the contract and actually share the financial risk with Dave. They are like the general contractors of this project.
Okay, so the syndicate shares the risk. Then what is the selling group?
Think of the selling group as the specialized subcontractors. The syndicate brings them in just to help distribute the stock to a rider audience. But the selling group members do not sign the underwriting agreement with the issuer, and they take absolutely zero financial risk.
Really? Zero?
Zero. If the stock doesn't sell, the selling group just shrugs, packs up, and walks away. They only earn a small fee, a selling concession, for the specific shares they manage to place with investors.
So if there's an exam question about who assumes the liability for unsold shares, it is never the selling group. It's the syndicate.
Always the syndicate.
Okay, pattern interrupt. Stop what you are doing. Seriously, if you were doing the dishes or staring at a spreadsheet, tune back in right now.
Yeah, listen up.
The Series 6 exam absolutely loves to test role identification. It will give you a scenario and ask, who is doing this? Broker, agent, dealer, or issuer? It sounds basic, but it gets tricky really fast.
Let's run a rapid drill on this. I'll give the action. You identify the role.
Bring it on.
Who is responsible for the actual issuance of the stock, creating the shares, and filing that initial SEC registration?
That's the issuer. In our story, that's Frank the founder.
Correct. Okay. Who is distributing the securities to the public for a fee, acting as the corporate entity?
That is the broker dealer. That's Dave's firm.
And finally, who is affecting transactions as an individual human being?
That's the agent. An agent is a natural person, a human being with a pulse, talking on the phone to the customer. So Dave, the individual guy, is acting as an agent for Dave's broker-dealer firm.
Spot on. Mastering the difference between the corporate entity taking the risk and the individual human doing the talking will save you on at least 3 or 4 tricky questions on the test.
All right, let's keep moving. So Dave's firm is distributing the stock. We know during that 20-day cooling off period, he can't make a formal sales pitch and he can't take money. But Dave still wants to market Frank's company. What is he legally allowed to publish in the newspaper without triggering an illegal unregistered offer?
The SEC allows a very specific, highly restricted type of advertisement called a tombstone ad.
Which sounds incredibly depressing for a hype campaign. Like, come invest in our tombstone.
It looks depressing on purpose. That's literally why the industry calls it a tombstone. It is a plain, rigid, black and white, boxed-in advertisement.
So boring.
Exactly. The SEC wants to strip all the emotion and hype out of the process entirely. It only contains the bare-bones facts. The name of the issuer, the names of the underwriters, the number of shares, and how the price will be determined. It basically says, this security exists. Here is where to get the preliminary prospectus if you want to read it.
Let me test this logic then.
Yeah.
What if Dave includes a quote from Cautious Carla in his tombstone ad? It's a tiny little quote at the bottom saying, I've reviewed this dog sunglasses stock and it's a guaranteed winner.
The moment Dave does that, he has committed a federal securities violation. A tombstone ad can never, under any circumstances, contain performance projections, testimonials, or any persuasive sales language. If it includes a recommendation, the SEC no longer considers it a tombstone ad. They consider it an illegal, non-compliant prospectus.
So it's literally just a birth announcement for a stock.
Yeah.
Here's the baby. Here are the parents. Ask the doctor for the paperwork if you want the details.
A very sterile birth announcement, yes. Now, speaking of that paperwork, the SEC is utterly obsessed with making sure investors actually receive the prospectus.
Yeah.
The prospectus is the ultimate disclosure document. It has all the risks, the financials, everything. And there are incredibly strict deadlines for delivering it.
Looking at the outline here, let's tackle the 48-hour rule first. What is this? And more importantly, who does it actually apply to?
The 48-hour rule dictates that the broker-dealer must deliver the preliminary prospectus, our red herring, to the customer at least 48 hours before sending the confirmation of sale.
Let me think about the why here. 48 hours before the trade confirms. So the SEC wants to ensure cautious Carla has at least 2 full days to sit on her couch, read through the risks, and realize that a startup making prescription dog goggles might not be the safest place for her retirement money.
That is the exact legislative intent. They want her to have a cool down period to actually read the risks. But here is the massive exam trap.
Okay, what is it?
This 48-hour rule only applies to IPOs of first-time issuers, companies that are not currently reporting to the SEC.
Wait, really? So if Microsoft or Apple issues a new batch of stock to the public, Dave doesn't have to follow the 48-hour rule for Carla?
He does not.
Oh, wow.
And the reason why is the efficient market hypothesis. Microsoft is already a known entity. They file 10Ks, 10Qs. The market analysts cover them daily on CNBC. All their information is already public and priced into the stock.
That makes sense.
The SEC says, Carla doesn't need 48 hours to research Microsoft. The market has already done the research. The 48-hour pause is only for companies stepping into the public light for the very first time.
That makes total sense when you frame it around market efficiency.
Yeah.
But what about after the IPO? The stock goes post-effective. It starts trading in the open market, the secondary market. People are buying and selling it on an exchange. Does Dave still have to hand out prospectuses to new buyers?
He does. And this is known as aftermarket prospectus delivery.
Okay.
Even if Carla buys the stock a month after the IPO from some random guy on the internet, she still needs to know what she's buying. The dealer must deliver a final prospectus for a specific number of days after the effective date, and the exam will relentlessly test you on these exact windows.
Let's do a direct side-by-side comparison of these aftermarket timelines so we can really spot the patterns here.
Let's start with a standard unlisted IPO. This is a company that was not previously reporting to the SEC, and they are not listing on a major exchange like the NYSE or NASDAQ. Maybe they're just trading over the counter.
Okay.
The aftermarket delivery requirement here is 90 days.
90 days. So for 3 full months after Frank goes public, every single person who buys the stock gets the massive legal packet. That is a really long time.
It is, because an unlisted first-time company is the highest risk scenario with the lowest visibility. The SEC forces the disclosure window wide open.
Okay, what if Frank is a first-time issuer, but his company is so impressive that he manages to list directly on the NASDAQ right out of the gate? An exchange-listed IPO.
The window shrinks dramatically. For an exchange-listed IPO, it is only 25 days.
Why the massive drop from 90 to 25 just because it's on an exchange? I mean, it's the same company.
Because the major exchanges have their own rigorous listing requirements. If NASDAQ lets Frank in, they've already vetted his financials to some degree, and the exchange provides instantaneous pricing and volume visibility to the public.
Oh, right.
The SEC acknowledges that transparency and shortens the burden on the broker-dealers.
So 90 days for unlisted IPOs, 25 days for listed IPOs. What if the company is not a first-time issuer at all? They're just doing an additional follow-on offering.
The statutory default for an unlisted follow-on offering is 40 days.
Okay, so we have 90, 40, and 25. But reading through the study notes, there is one ultimate trap here. What if the company was already an Exchange Act reporting company, and they're listed on an exchange, and they do an additional offering, like the Microsoft example again? What is the aftermarket delivery requirement then?
The answer is 0 days. Not 25, not 10. Zero.
Again, because the market already knows everything.
Exactly. The SEC basically says, we don't need to force aftermarket prospectus delivery. The info is already out there on the SEC's IDGRR system.
0 days. I love a clean answer. Okay, so Frank, the founder, is exhausted. He's looking at all this, the gun jumping rules, the 20-day cooling off minimum, the depressing tombstone ads, the 90-day delivery windows. He looks at Devious Dave and says, Dave, this registration process is a bureaucratic nightmare. It's going to cost me millions in legal fees alone. Can we just skip SEC registration entirely?
And Dave's eyes light up, because yes, you can. The Securities Act provides exemptions, but there are massive, highly testable caveats to skipping the line.
Let's start with securities that are just inherently exempt because of the nature of who is issuing them. The notes call these exempt by class.
The heavy hitters in this category are U.S. government securities, municipal bonds, bank securities, and short-term commercial paper.
Let's poke at that a bit. Why are U.S. government and municipal bonds exempt?
Because they have sovereign taxing power. The risk of the U.S. Treasury defaulting is virtually zero compared to Frank's dog sunglasses startup.
Fair.
The SEC doesn't need to force the federal government to write a risk prospectus about itself. It's just redundant.
Fair point. But what about commercial paper? The rule says it's exempt if it's short term. How short is short term?
Maximum maturity of 270 days. If the commercial paper matures in 271 days, it loses the exemption entirely and must be fully registered.
Why 270 days? What's the magic there? Why not a full year?
It's really about the purpose of the money. Under 270 days, it's considered short-term operational financing like meeting payroll next month or buying inventory. It's primarily bought by institutional investors.
Okay.
Once you cross that nine-month mark, regulators view it as long-term risk capital, and they want retail investors protected by a full registration.
Okay, so if you're the government, a bank, or issuing 270-day paper, you skip the registration line. But here is the massive exam trap, and I want to make sure I have this logic right. Does exempt from registration mean exempt from the law?
Never. Never, ever. And the exam will try to trick you with this exact phrasing. Exempt from registration is never exempt from the anti-fraud provisions of the Securities Acts. Fraud is illegal always in every single securities transaction, period.
So if Dave the dealer flat out lies to Carla about the interest rate on an exempt municipal bond, he can't go to court and say, hey, Your Honor, it's an exempt security. I can say whatever I want.
No, the SEC will still throw him in federal prison under the anti-fraud provision. However, there is a very nuanced carve out here.
Okay.
While intentional fraud is always illegal, government, municipal, and bank securities are carved out of the civil liability provisions for material misstatements.
Wait, explain that difference. What does that mean?
If Frank the founder accidentally makes a typo in his corporate prospectus, Carla can sue him in civil court for her losses. But you cannot easily sue the U.S. government in civil court for a typo in a treasury bond offering.
Because of sovereign immunity.
Exactly. Sovereign immunity protects them from civil liability. But the SEC can still go after individuals for criminal intentional fraud.
That is a brilliant distinction.
Okay.
But back to Frank. His dog sunglasses company is not a bank, and it's definitely not the U.S. government. So he can't use those class exemptions. How else can he skip registration?
He can look at transactional exemptions, starting with the intrastate exemption, widely known as Rule 147. This is designed for local, homegrown businesses.
Intrastate, meaning within one single state. So the theory here is, if Frank only raises money from people living in his home state of, let's say, Texas, the federal SEC doesn't need to get involved because it hasn't crossed state lines.
Exactly. It stems directly from the U.S. Constitution's Commerce Clause. The federal government only has jurisdiction over interstate commerce. If everything stays inside Texas, the SEC steps back and lets the Texas state regulators handle it. Think of it like a local farmer's market for stock.
I love the farmer's market analogy. Okay, so Frank wants to sell his stock only to Texans. What are the rules he has to follow to keep the SEC away?
First, Frank's business has to genuinely be a local Texas business, not just some shell company with a P.O. box. He has to pass one of the 80% tests.
Okay, what are those?
Either 80% of his gross revenues come from in-state operations, 80% of his assets are located in-state, or 80% of the proceeds from this stock sale will be used in-state. Alternatively, he needs a majority of his employees based in-state. And the key here is he only needs to pass one of those tests, not all of them.
Okay, so Frank passes the asset test. All his dog sunglass factories are right there in Texas. He starts selling shares. He successfully sells 9,999 shares to local Texans. But Devious Dave gets sloppy, and he accidentally sells one single share to a guy who lives 10 feet across the border in Oklahoma. What happens to the exemption?
The whole thing goes up in flames.
Just from one share.
Just one. The statutory intrastate exemption is an all-or-nothing test. It is strict liability. The SEC doesn't care that Dave made an honest mistake. That one out-of-state sale to the Oklahoma guy destroys the entire federal exemption for every single purchaser.
Wow.
Suddenly, Frank is retroactively running a massive, illegal, unregistered federal offering.
One share destroys the whole thing. That is brutal. Now, that's the original statutory Rule 147, but your notes mention a modernized safe harbor for intrastate offerings. Why do they update it?
Because of the internet. Under the original rigid rule, If Frank even offered the stock to someone out of state, say he posted about his farmer's market stock on an open website and someone in New York just looked at the webpage, the exemption was dead.
Because it's an offer across state lines.
Exactly. So the modernized safe harbor, Rule 147A, adapts to reality. It says, okay, Frank, you can advertise out of state. You can post it on the open internet.
Can the out-of-state people actually buy it?
No. And that's the critical difference. The modernized rule lets you advertise across state lines, but you are still legally restricted to only selling to verified in-state residents.
So I can look at the Texas farmers market online from New York, but if I try to put the tomatoes in my digital cart, I have to prove I have a Texas address.
Right.
But what stops a Texan from buying the stock and immediately flipping it to their cousin in Oklahoma for a quick profit? Doesn't that defeat the whole purpose?
It would, which is why the SEC mandates a six-month lockup. Under the interstate exemption, resales to out-of-state persons are strictly prohibited for 6 months from the date of the last sale by the issuer. The stock has to come to rest in the home state first.
Got it. Okay, Frank looks at this farmer's market idea. He looks at the strict liability of the state borders, and he says, Dave, I need bigger money. I want investors from New York, California, everywhere. But I still refuse to do a full SEC registration.
Then Dave introduces Frank to the VIP club of the securities world. Regulation D, private placements.
Regulation D. Let's unpack this. Reg D allows Frank to raise money across state lines without registering. But he can't just sell it to anyone walking down the street. He needs VIPs. And in this context, a VIP is called an accredited investor.
Yes. This is hands down one of the most heavily tested concepts on the Series 6. You must know exactly who qualifies as an accredited investor. There is an income test and a net worth test.
Let's test my memory. The income test. You need an income of $200,000 as an individual for the last 2 years, or $300,000 joint with a spouse, and you have to reasonably expect to make the same this current year.
Spot on. That proves you have sustained high earning power, but what about the net worth test?
A net worth of $1 million. Right. But looking at your warnings here, there is a massive exam trap attached to that million. It is $1 million excluding the value of the primary residence.
Yes. Let's bring Cautious Carla back into the mix to illustrate why this matters. Let's say Carla owns a beautiful beachfront house worth $2 million, completely paid off, free and clear. But she only has $50 in her checking account and no other investable assets. Is Carla an accredited investor?
If I'm just doing basic math, her net worth is $2 million plus $50, so she's a multimillionaire. But the rule says exclude the house. So if we strip away the house, Carla's net worth is $50. She is definitely not accredited. But why is the SEC so harsh about the house?
Because of liquidity and survival. The SEC's logic is that your house is an illiquid asset, and fundamentally, you need a place to live.
Right.
A primary residence does not represent liquid risk capital that you can afford to lose on Frank's highly speculative dog sunglasses. If the company goes bankrupt, the SEC doesn't want Carla losing her home.
That logic makes perfect sense. It's about protecting people from risking their shelter on a startup. Now, Dave wants to use Reg D to raise this money. What are his actual structural options? Because the notes list three different variants of Reg D that we really need to know.
Let's do a direct comparison so listeners can build a mental map. Option one is the small offering exemption under Rule 504. Frank can raise up to $10 million. The unique thing here is that anyone can buy. Accredited or non-accredited doesn't matter.
Oh, wow.
But Dave cannot use general advertising or solicitation.
Okay, so maximum $10 million. You can't put up billboards, but you can sell to everyday people.
Right. Option two is the traditional variant, Rule 506B. This is the classic private placement. Frank can raise an absolutely unlimited amount of money. He can sell to an unlimited number of accredited investors. And Davey, he is allowed to sell to a maximum of 35 non-accredited investors, provided those 35 people are considered sophisticated.
Sophisticated? Does that mean they wear a monocle and drink fine wine? Like, what is the legal definition of sophisticated?
It means they have enough financial knowledge and experience to evaluate the risks and merits of the investment on their own. Or they have hired a purchaser representative, like a CPA or a lawyer who does it for them.
Okay, that makes more sense.
But again, under this traditional variant, absolutely no general advertising is allowed. Dave has to have a pre-existing, substantive relationship with these investors before he pitches them.
So what if Frank really wants to run Facebook ads, put up billboards in Times Square, and just blast this to the entire world?
Then he uses option three, the general solicitation variant, Rule 506C. Here, Frank can still raise unlimited money. He can advertise on billboards and the internet, but what's the trade-off?
If he's blasting it to the public, he can have zero non-accredited investors.
Exactly, not 35. Zero. And because he is soliciting the general public, the SEC doesn't let him off the hook easily. Dave, the dealer, must take reasonable steps to verify that every single buyer who clicks that ad is actually an accredited investor.
So he can't just take their word for it?
No, he can't just have them check a box on a web form saying, "Trust me, I'm rich." He has to actually review their W-2s, their tax returns, their bank statements. It's a huge compliance burden.
Let me summarize that, because I can see how a multiple choice question would mix those up. Traditional variant, up to 35 non-accredited, but no ads. General solicitation variant, ads are totally fine, but zero non-accredited, and you must verify their tax returns.
You've got it perfectly. And regardless of which Reg D option they use, Frank isn't completely invisible to the regulators. He has to tell the SEC that he raised the money by filing a document called Form D.
Does he have to file that before he starts selling, like asking for permission?
No, and that's a very common test trick. Form D must be filed within 15 calendar days after the first sale.
After?
Yes, it is a notice filing, not a permission slip. You don't ask the SEC for permission to use a Reg D exemption. You claim the exemption, raise the money, and then you notify them that you did it.
Within 15 days after the first sale.
Got it.
Okay, so Frank successfully raised his money from the VIPs. His dog sunglasses company is off and running. Let's leave Frank behind and focus on Devious Dave.
Okay, moving on to Dave.
Dave's broker-dealer firm is expanding. He's moved beyond corporate startup stocks and is now underwriting municipal bonds. He's trying to sell bonds for a brand new city dog park in Chicago.
Now, when you cross over into municipal new issues, you are opening a completely different rule book. The most important baseline fact to remember, municipal bonds do not have an SEC prospectus.
Okay, so if I'm taking the exam and I see a multiple choice answer linking the word prospectus to a municipal bond,
it is immediately the wrong answer. Cross it out.
Done.
Municipalities are exempt from the Securities Act of 1933, again, due to sovereign immunity and federalism. Instead, they use parallel disclosure documents created under the rules of the MSRB, the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board.
So what are these substitute documents called? We need to know the muni vocabulary.
Instead of a red herring preliminary prospectus, munis have a POS, a preliminary official statement.
POS.
Right. Functionally, it works just like a red herring. It is a draft document missing the final interest rates and final offering prices.
And the final document. The equivalent of the final prospectus.
That is the OS, the official statement. This has all the final rates, prices, and maturity schedules. The municipal dealer must deliver this OS to the customer by the time the trade settles. And crucially, the underwriter has a regulatory obligation to post this final OS to EMMA.
EMMA. What is EMMA?
It stands for the Electronic Municipal Market Access Platform. It is the MSRB's centralized public website where anyone, retail investors, analysts, regulators, can go look up the final terms, trading data, and disclosures of any municipal bond.
Okay, so POS is the rough draft, OS is the final draft, and it lives on EMMA. But reading further down in the muni section here, there's a third document that seems designed specifically to confuse test takers. The notice of sale. What is that?
The exam trap here is knowing exactly who the notice of sale is meant for. A notice of sale is a highly technical document published in a trade newspaper called The Bond Buyer. It is used by the issuing municipality, like the city of Chicago, to solicit competitive bids from underwriting syndicates.
Let me make sure I understand the mechanism here. It's basically the city putting out a classified ad to Wall Street saying, "Hey, we need to borrow $10 million for this new dog park. We're taking bids. Which syndicate will offer us the lowest interest rate?"
That is exactly how the competitive bidding process works. The notice of sale dictates the terms of the auction. Therefore, it is strictly a communication between the issuer and the underwriters. It is not for retail investors.
So if an exam question says, "Gosh's Carla received a notice of sale in the mail."
Dave messed up. Or the exam is testing your ability to spot a wrong answer. Retail investors do not receive the notice of sale.
That makes total sense when you understand who is talking to who. Okay, let's look at Dave's firm itself. Dave is getting huge. He's underwriting munis. He's slinging private placements. But because he's Devious Dave, his firm is growing way too fast and getting sloppy. The regulators step in. The last section of our study guide covers broker-dealer edge cases and record keeping.
Let's start with the bank networking rule. Dave decides he wants more casual retail foot traffic, so he strikes a deal to set up a broker-dealer desk right inside the physical lobby of a local bank.
I have actually seen this. You go to deposit a check at your local branch, and there's a guy in a suit sitting behind a glass partition offering mutual funds.
It's a very common business model, but it creates a massive psychological risk for cautious Carla. If Carla walks into her trusted bank to buy a security from Dave, she might subconsciously assume that investment has the exact same safety guarantees as her savings account.
Ah, she thinks because she bought it in a bank building, it's backed by the FDIC.
Precisely. To combat that confusion, Fyron requires Dave to disclose three specific facts in writing to Carla before she's allowed to open an account. Number one, the securities are not FDIC insured. Number two, they are not bank guaranteed. And number three, they are subject to investment risk, including the possible loss of principal.
Not FDIC insured, not bank guaranteed, subject to risk. Let me guess, if Dave forgets to get her signature on just one of those.
It's a severe compliance violation.
Yeah.
The exam loves this. They will give you a list of four disclosures and ask which one is not required by the bank networking rule. You have to have those three specific negative disclosures memorized.
Okay, here's a pattern interrupt for you, because when I read this next rule in the notes, I thought it was a joke. It sounds made up, but it's a real regulation, the taping rule.
The taping rule is fascinating because it's a direct response to how the dark side of the industry actually operates.
Right.
The SEC and FINRA have a sort of bad apple radar. If a firm gets expelled from the industry for egregious sales practice violations, like running a high-pressure boiler room, the regulators know exactly what happens next. Those shady brokers don't just quit finance, they go look for new jobs.
They disperse like roaches when the lights turn on. And Dave, who is always looking for aggressive salespeople willing to push the envelope, starts hiring them up.
And FINRA watches him do it. If Dave hires too many registered reps from these disciplined firms, meaning firms that were expelled by a self-regulatory organization or whose registration was revoked by the SEC, Dave's entire firm triggers the taping rule. They become a designated taping firm.
Meaning he literally has to set up tape recorders on the phones.
Every single phone call between his registered reps and customers must be recorded. He has to tape them, implement a system to review them, and keep those recordings on file for 3 years, with the first 2 years readily accessible.
That is wild. It's like regulators putting the entire office on probation automatically because of who you hired. But what is the actual threshold? How many bad apples spoil the bunch before Dave has to buy the tape recorders?
The exam focuses heavily on the threshold for a mid-sized firm, which FINRA defines as a firm with 10 to 19 registered persons. What is the threshold that triggers the rule for them?
The notes say the threshold is exactly 4 registered persons. And there is a huge warning here for the exam. It is a fixed number, not a percentage. The exam will try to trick you by saying 40% of the sales force.
Right.
But for a 10 to 19 person firm, if you hire exactly 4 reps from expelled firms, you trigger the rule. Why 4? Why not 3 or 5?
Regulators actually ran the statistical modeling on this. Once a firm hits about a 20 to 25% concentration of personnel from expelled firms, the culture of the new firm demonstrably shifts.
Oh, wow.
It's no longer just one bad apple you can isolate. It's a critical mass that turns the new firm into a boiler room incubator. 4 is the tipping point for a mid-sized firm.
That context makes it so much easier to remember. And speaking of keeping those tapes for 3 years, let's hit the general record-keeping rules. Dave opens a new account for Carla. He has to create a customer account record with her name, address, tax ID, and her investment profile.
This is fundamental compliance. When does Dave actually have to furnish a copy of that completed profile to Carla so she can verify it's accurate?
The rule is he must furnish it to the customer within 30 days of opening the account.
And when she signs off on it, do they just file it away in a cabinet forever?
No, because people's lives change, right? They have to recertify it. The firm must send that profile back out to the customer at least every 36 months to make sure her investment objectives or financial situation hasn't shifted.
30 days to open, 36 months to refresh. And as a general rule of thumb for the exam, most core operational records like trade blotters, ledgers, and those customer account records need to be retained for 3 to 6 years, with the first 2 years kept in a readily accessible location.
Okay, energy shift. We are at the finish line. Let's do a rapid-fire recap of everything we just covered to really lock it in.
Yeah.
I'm going to fire off the top 5 must-knows from this entire deep dive, and you nail the answers. Ready?
Let's do it.
Question 1. What 3 specific items are missing from a red herring preliminary prospectus?
The final offering price, the effective date, and the net proceeds to the issuer.
Question 2. In an underwriting agreement, who is left holding the financial bag for unsold shares in a best efforts deal?
the issuer. Best efforts means the underwriter is just an agent. The risk and the unsold shares go right back to the issuer.
Question 3. Cautious Carla has a $2 million house free and clear and only 50 bucks in her bank account. Is she an accredited investor?
No. You must strictly exclude the value of the primary residence from the $1 million net worth test.
Question 4. How many non-accredited investors are legally allowed in a Regulation D general solicitation offering where you run ads on the internet?
0. If you use general advertising, every single buyer must be an accredited investor, and the dealer must take reasonable steps to verify their tax documents.
Question 5. What is the taping rule threshold for a mid-sized 15-person broker-dealer firm?
4 registered persons. It is a fixed number of 4, not a percentage.
Boom. You nailed it. Now, to wrap up this entire study session, we've talked about a lot of granular rules, but if we zoom out and look at the big picture, why is the SEC so manic about all this? Why the 20-day pauses, the exemptions, the verification requirements?
It really comes down to something foundational called the competition mandate. The SEC isn't just a police force designed to say no to everything. By law, they have a dual mandate, a delicate balancing act. They have to prioritize investor protection, absolutely. But they also have to consider efficiency, competition, and capital formation.
Capital formation, meaning making sure real businesses can actually get the money they need to build factories, hire people, and grow the economy.
That is the tug of war. If the SEC made every single company, no matter how small, go through a full multi-million dollar federal registration just to raise 50 grand, small businesses would die.
Right.
Reg D and Rule 147 exist because the SEC is legally forced to carve out pathways that keep capital flowing. They are constantly trying to balance protecting cautious Carla from being scammed without smothering Frank the founder's ability to innovate.
So as you head into your Series 6 exam, keep that tension in mind. Every single rule you just learned is the result of that tug of war. And here is a thought to chew on. As new technologies emerge, things like digital assets, tokenized securities, and algorithmic trading, how is the SEC going to adapt? How do they keep that regulatory X-ray machine working, keeping Carla safe in a digital world, without making it impossible for Frank to build his next big idea?
That tension isn't just test material. It is the central question that defines the entire modern financial market.
Think about that the next time you see a boring tombstone ad in the paper. Good luck on the Series 6, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.